You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. I hope everybody survived D.C.'s blizzard of 2013 yesterday. It's great how quickly the city got its act back together. You know, there's no snow out there now, so it's a great testimony to Washington, D.C. I'm Darrell West, Vice President of Governance Studies and Director of the Center for Technology Innovation at the Brookings Institution, and I'd like to welcome you to this forum on mobile technology. And we are webcasting this event live, so a warm welcome to our viewers from around the country and around the world. We will be archiving this video, so anybody who wishes to view it after today will have an opportunity to do so through our brookings.edu website. We also welcome any comments or questions that you have. We have set up a Twitter feed at hashtag TechCTI. That's hashtag TechCTI. So if you wish to post any comments during the forum, you are welcome to do so. By the end of this year, it is estimated that there will be more internet-connected devices in the world than people. Mobile usage is rising rapidly, and wireless applications enable users to exchange information on healthcare, finance, transportation, education, and many other activities. Today, we're going to be discussing the nature of innovation and some of these new models of service delivery that are emerging, both in the United States as well as around the world. We will talk about how cities, states, and countries are using mobile technology to deliver services and help people. We will look at what progress has been made and what we can do moving forward in order to facilitate continued development. And this event is part of our mobile economy project that looks at the impact of the mobile revolution in many different areas. We're going to have two sets of experts who will discuss innovation, invention, and the effects of mobile technology. And to help us understand this subject, we're going to start with remarks from Dean Brenner. And Dean is Senior Vice President of Government Affairs at Qualcomm Incorporated. In that position, he directs the company's initiatives related to spectrum and telecommunications policy. He represents the company before the Federal Communications Commission and other agencies. In addition, he's responsible for global spectrum acquisitions and strategy. So, Dean, thank you very much.
Good morning. On behalf of Qualcomm, I'd like to start by thanking Darrell and Brookings for researching and fostering discussions on the tremendous impact that mobile technologies are having on people and communities around the world. Qualcomm is very proud to support the Mobile Economy Project, and I'm, of course, personally honored to be a part of today's event and to hear from our distinguished panelists and all of you in the audience. Now, for those of you who may not be familiar with Qualcomm, we are the world's largest manufacturer of chips for cell phones and other wireless devices. We're also the world's largest licensor of mobile technology because we license our technology to virtually every company in the world who makes cell phones, tablets, other wireless devices, or infrastructure equipment. This may be the only event in Washington today where you're not going to be told to turn off your cell phone. If you have a 3G or a 4G phone, and I suspect that almost everyone here does, you're using our technology that we invented at our headquarters in San Diego and that then we shared with our partners who made the phone that's in your pocket. So for more than 28 years, when Qualcomm was founded, the invention of mobile technology has been our central focus. Together with our partners, we've helped to enable people all over the world to use wireless devices to improve virtually every facet of life. Now, today, there are approximately 6.7 billion mobile subscriptions around the world. A subscription means some people could have two devices, and there could be machines that are used by companies that don't relate to a person. So there are 6.7 billion subscriptions, but which is really an astonishing fact if you think about it, because the world's population is only 7.1 billion. So we are actually almost what Darrell said with one subscription, one device per person. So what we like to say at Qualcomm, and I think it's no exaggeration to say it, is that mobile is the largest communications platform in the history of the world, which is a gigantic statement. So in particular, there are about 2.3 billion 3G or 4G connections around the world. So as you're going to hear today, and as you just know from living, the potential of mobile broadband to improve people's lives, to empower people across all socioeconomic classes is truly tremendous. Mobile technology is promoting opportunity and economic development all over the world, and that's why over the last year, Brookings has done a wide variety of research and very interesting discussions, all led by Daryl, on some of the areas where mobile is having such a profound impact, including microfinance, public safety, education, and healthcare. Today, you're going to hear about yet other areas, including the ingenious use of mobile technology to improve parking, yes, parking, from our great partner Streetline, to conduct surveys, yes, surveys, from M-Survey. As you also hear today, invention is crucial to making all this happen. At Qualcomm, we believe that invention in mobile technology can never stop. We invest a huge amount of money in research and development. So in 2013, we spent $5 billion on R&D, which is more than 20% of our annual revenues. So 20 cents for every dollar of revenue, not profit, revenue that we receive goes right back into research and development. Why do we do that? We do that because we understand that making advancements in wireless technology, inventing new technology, it's not cheap, it's not easy, but it's essential. And it's an engine that's not stopping. Our commitment to invention led us to commission a global survey on the topic, the Time Invention Poll, which you're going to hear more about today, conducted in cooperation with Qualcomm, asked people in 17 countries around the world about their attitudes and opinions about invention. And the results were truly remarkable. 40% of the respondents said that the digital revolution from 1980 through today was the most inventive period worldwide. 71% of global consumers said the cell phone is the most useful invention. Not only is digital technology felt to be an important end product of invention, but it's also seen to have made the invention process itself easier today than ever before. Over 50% of the respondents believe that inventions drive economic growth, and this is particularly true in emerging markets where 59% of the respondents said invention supports a strong economy. And I think we all know this, as I say, from just living. Equally impressive, though, were people's perceptions of how important it is to protect the ideas that drive inventions. Globally, the United States is viewed as the gold standard in protecting intellectual property. 40% of global consumers said that the United States was the country that does the best job of protecting ideas. Invention is also seen as collaborative. While the inventor remains central, sharing ideas and working collectively is recognized to be positive for invention. At the same time, patents, which are core to Qualcomm's existence, are seen as crucial for the invention process, and in turn, protection of inventions is encouraging more invention. Now, this survey confirmed a lot of what we believe here at Qualcomm, but the breadth and depth of the appreciation around the world for the invention process and the importance that consumers place on keeping these inventions going was striking even to us. Today, I hope will give us even more examples and insight into how the combination of ingenuity and the inventive spirit are leading to breakthrough advances in the use of mobile technology here in the United States and around the world in so many different ways. So at Qualcomm, we foresee great things ahead for the mobile industry, ideas and solutions that are addressing many of our most pressing global challenges, cutting-edge mobile technologies that improve and impact social and economic development on a global scale and in tremendous ways. So I look forward to hearing the rest of today's event, and I hope you all enjoy the day. Thank you.
So while these individuals are getting mic'd up, I want to thank Dean for those opening comments. And it certainly is impressive, those device numbers that he was talking about. I know in my household there are two people, and we have eight devices between my wife and myself. And it seems like every week there's another option that is appearing. We're going to move to our first panel, which is going to focus on the role of invention in mobile technology. And the moderator for this session is Michael Duffy, who is the deputy managing editor at Time Magazine. Michael joined Time in 1985 as a Pentagon correspondent. He has covered Congress and the White House and served as Washington Bureau Chief, Nation Editor, and Executive Editor of the magazine. He's written more than 50 Time cover stories. He's won the Gerald R. Ford Award for reporting, both on the White House and on the defense and national security area. With a team from Time, he has shared in the Joan Shorenstein Barone Prize for Investigative Journalism, awarded by the Kennedy School of Government. Along with Time Managing Editor Nancy Gibbs, he is the co-author of two best-selling presidential histories. One is The President's Club, Inside the World's Most Exclusive Fraternity, and a second book, The Preacher and the President's, Billy Graham in the White House. And I also want to point out today is a particularly busy day for Michael. We're really pleased that he took time out of his schedule because you probably already have heard Time today announced its Person of the Year being Pope Francis. So we tried to get him for the keynote, but he was a little tied up. But great choice, Michael. Thank you.
Good morning. Thanks for the introduction. He is something of an innovator, so I did think about bringing him, but this panel is more about invention, which maybe when we have the reinvention panel, we'll bring the Pope. Thank you very much. My household, 10 people, five people, 10 devices, and counting. It seems it may go up at Christmas. I'm not quite sure. No matter who we are, where we're from, we love a good invention myth, and we're taught them from the beginning of our lives, whether it's Newton and his apple, Archimedes and his bathwater buoyancy displacement, or even Philo Farnsworth and his plow going back and forth across the field, which led to the idea for television. This is a powerful idea that I think we all grew up with, which is how things start, where they come from, what makes us think creatively, what is it a spark or is it something more collective, and is that changing? I'm going to ask our two experts here to talk about that in a minute, but first a couple of thoughts of my own. I do think we're living in a kind of golden age of invention because for not just years or even decades, but centuries, there have been limits in terms of education and computation and sharing of ideas across borders. All of those barriers are disappearing, and they're disappearing in our lifetimes, and they're disappearing fast. It's fairly recent. It feels to me like it's accelerating. And yet at the core of the process of making things new or making things new again, reinvention, it's got to be, at some point, an individual act. And I want to explore that a little bit today with our two experts, and I hope you guys can talk about that in your opening remarks or anything else you think is more relevant than what I've just laid out, which shouldn't be too hard. We have two great innovators here today. John Villasenor is a senior fellow at Brookings. He specializes in digital technology, public policy, and the law. He's an affiliate at Stanford's Center for International Security and Cooperation, and is a vice chair of the World Economic Forum's Global Agenda Council on Intellectual Property System. He attended UVA and then went on to get a master's and a PhD from Stanford, so he's an underachiever. Also with us today is John Sauer, who's the communications chief for Water for People, which works to ensure safe, affordable, and sustainable drinking water and sanitation for people around the globe. Though John is with us here today, he's worked for more than 20 years in humanitarian projects from Russia to Uganda. He's a graduate of Fordham and has a master's in international intercultural management from the School of International Training in Brattleboro. These guys are much smarter than I am. So I'm glad you are going to take the questions and I'm going to ask them. But before I do, if you could just talk for a few minutes each, and why don't you start, John? This John, the immediate John to my right, and then you can follow. Is that okay? Yeah. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you very much. I think we are indeed living in an age where there's just a spectacular opportunity for invention. One of the things I'd like I'd really like to say two kind of broad things. One is that despite the incredible complexity of today's devices and systems, there's still a real role for the sole inventor, the individual innovator. And I'll give a very specific example of that. Recently, a venture capital company I do some work for asked me to visit a company founded by a person who's trying to invent a better microphone. And you might think, well, you know, is the microphone market that big? Mm-hmm. And microphones aren't only the things that, you know, singers hold on stage. Microphones are in every tablet, in every smartphone. In fact, tablets often have multiple microphones. So the number of microphones that get sold each year in the world is truly staggering, hundreds of millions or maybe pushing a billion. Hmm. And it turns out that the way most microphones today, including most of the microphones probably in your pockets and your phones, are they use a vibrating diaphragm. Basically, you vocalize, you vibrate the air, the diaphragm vibrates. But this gentleman thinks you can do it with something called a piezoelectric solution. And he has spent 8 years doing nothing else. And he did a PhD at University of Michigan doing it, and now he's started a startup company to try to commercialize it. And just 2 months ago, he was awarded a U.S. patent for his invention. And, you know, it's too early to know whether his company will succeed. But that, to me, is a really important example of you know, the role of the single creative innovator, and how we absolutely still need those people, and those people can and will continue to change the world. The other final comment I'll make is that one of the great aspects of inventions and innovation is that they have these incredible downstream consequences that could have been very hard to predict. And Qualcomm is a great example, as a great innovator in mobile technology. Just some numbers that you may have one time I've known, but perhaps have forgotten. Back in the 1980s, the mid-1980s, the first car-based mobile phone solutions were offered. They cost about $2,500. That's back in 1980, $5 or $4. That's probably, you know, significantly more today. So on an inflation-adjusted basis, the cheapest feature phones, non-smartphones, are now about 80 times cheaper than they were back in the 1980s. And mobile phones, which were in some cases criticized in the 1980s as toys for the very wealthy, of course, have literally changed the world in every single corner of the planet and have benefited people really from every walk of life and every level of the economic spectrum. And so those are some of the incredible consequences that perhaps even the original inventors of a lot of the technology behind mobile phones wouldn't have necessarily foreseen, but because of strong intellectual property protections and the incentives that go with them, we collectively have changed, or those of us who have been involved in mobile technology and companies like Qualcomm have really changed the world.
All right, so John, do you want to follow, and then we'll take some questions?
Sure. I would sort of say that given the complexity of a lot of the intractable problems that we see out there, and I think, you know, the person of the year being Pope Francis, his whole push is to solve global poverty. I mean, if we look at those kinds of global poverty issues, to really solve those, I think the kind of innovations or the kind of inventions that we're going to need to see are going to be things that cross silos. I think we've tried to solve these problems in silos. You know, we've got the health community, we've got, you know, the agriculture community. Whereas the reality is, I think solving those issues, it's going to take really working across those lines to get to the solutions that we need to do. Mobile certainly helping that. I mean, I can look at an example of our own sector, and I'm in the water sector, water sanitation sector, and we were faced with a problem that 30% of all the programs that are happening with water and sanitation are failing within 2 years. So what did we need to do? We went and we looked at the need to monitor, and to monitor effectively, we went and we looked at mobile, because we created a survey. It's called ACVO Flow, that survey tool that is on a Android-based phone, and now that's how we do all our monitoring across the world. And without taking, so it's also, I think, integrating with the different technologies that are out there. Take for example, I think we're seeing a big push to actually have that kind of that type of integration and this collective type of approach happening. You've got efforts such as Ashoka pushing issues like hybrid value chain work. You have this great research coming out of Stanford on collective impact and the work that's going on there. Now, these aren't inventions, but I think that we have to think of these things as all interrelated, and that if we can somehow spur on invention, that's taking into effect the ability, the need for us to work across these silos, across these sectors to actually solve these big intractable problems, I think we'll start to get somewhere a little bit faster. So.
John Villasenor, can you talk to me a little bit about why mobile may or may not be a particularly versatile platform for, take us up about 10,000 feet first, why this might be a particularly versatile platform for invention itself? Just what does it offer that perhaps other breakthrough technologies don't, as you look back? Don't go too far back in history. We don't need to go to the wheel. But as you think about it, both its potential and what it offers, talk to me about why this is a different.
Well, I think mobile is fascinating because mobile is an information portal, right? And so all of the, it really unifies. 20 or 30 years ago, we would have thought of wireless communications as one field and computers as a completely different field, right? And it puts all of these things together, and then having done that, it gives us the entire power of the internet and all of this. So we have unified and accessed through one device things that 20 years ago would have been in three different silos, really. And so just because of the wealth of capabilities that you have in these devices, there's that many more opportunities to innovate.
And can you talk also just a second about where its applications for data collection and chewing on that data and analyzing it take us to a different level? Just because I think for most of us who really just use it as a device to communicate with our children, we only can glimpse at this point where that road is going.
Well, I think that's a great question. I think many folks here may have heard of the phrase Internet of Things, which is a term that's sometimes used to really talk about a future where we're really sort of have already arrived at the beginning of that future where many objects, not just personal communication devices, are equipped with mobile communications technology. So appliances, automobiles, environmental monitoring, sensors, a long, long list of things. And so I think mobile 5 or 10 years from now certainly will still mean smartphones or whatever smartphones look like in 5 or 10 years, but it's also going to mean a world which sort of comes alive with lots of devices that are processing data, acquiring information, and that's all aided, of course, by advances in chip technology for acquiring all this information. And so I think there's an enormous number of possibilities there.
In the Time Qualcomm poll that we did last month, we asked people from, 16 or maybe 19 countries, I forget the number, it was a lot of countries, to list their the most valuable invention in their lives. And while the cell phone totally smoked the field, there were some other interesting answers I want to share in order to get back to John Sauer. And they differ depending on where you live. In rank of order after your device, that comes the disposable diaper, the alarm clock, Velcro, cruise control, and the rice cooker. You probably have all of these devices somewhere in your house, even if you don't know it. And there were some fascinating regional variations between those. Germans feel nearly as strongly about the vital nature of Velcro as people in the United Arab Emirates feel about cruise control. For more on this, you can go look at the poll. I'm not sure you need to know more, but it's there. John Sauer, since this is that was a more practical answer to what sometimes can become a theoretical question, someone who's working in water sanitation, talk to me a little bit about the invention you'd most like to see if you could snap your fingers.
I think you mentioned the sensor, John. I actually think there's been some interesting work done with sensors that could probably, could be stepped up if sensors were really, really inexpensive, for example. So one of the things that I remember Unilever had done was they put a sensor in a bar of soap so that they could monitor whether people were washing their hands or not. And, of course, that didn't work exactly the way they had planned it because in the developing world, families often break the soap in half and then share it amongst different households and et cetera. So the sensors didn't do the job. Another development that's happening right now is there are sensors on People are putting sensors on toilet doors to see if people are actually using the toilet. So there are some quite interesting things that could be done if these technologies, as they become cheaper, you know, even with the mobile phone, as the Android phone becomes, now there's maybe a $50 Android phone, as it becomes even cheaper, then this ability to do more regular data collection becomes a lot easier, because then people can, you know, they can have these surveys on their phones and they can actually be doing them on a more consistent basis. So I think it's, in some cases, it's not just the technology that's going to leapfrog, but it's actually the use of the technology, because if we look at the water sanitation sector, not everyone is monitoring as rigorously as some of us are. And to really address this problem, we do need to be monitoring that rigorously. Otherwise, we don't know what's failing, why it's failing. We can't see what's working and why it's working and try to make better decisions based on that data. So it's really the use of the technology as well, and that's really critical. One other point is, I think, the reinvention. If we think of the toilet, for example, actually an interesting poll in 2007 by the BMJ, formerly the British Medical Journal, of 11,000 of their readers said that sanitation had been the greatest invention in the past 166 years, and that beat out antibiotics, for example.
Velcro, apparently.
And Velcro and cruise control as well. Although I do like my cruise control on my German car. But I think if we then go back to, you know, 7.1 billion people on the planet that we heard, 4 billion still don't have access to sanitation. So we know this is a critical public health thing, but we haven't figured out globally how to address this. So I think we've got to find ways to get these technologies better used. And I think there will be innovations with, for example, with the toilet, that will use less water, that will be great for areas that can't get connected to the sewers or use no water, and find ways to kill the pathogens. And actually, the Gates Foundation has some very interesting work going on in that area called Reinvent the Toilet. So there you have it.
I want to ask John Villasena one more question, then we'll go to yours if there are. You had worked at NASA in jet propulsion in a previous life on Earth imaging. This is something most of us growing up in the 60s and 70s could not have imagined. It was a really big deal to have one picture of the Earth in 1969. Now, of course, you can punch up any piece of the Earth you want every morning. And you can have it fed to yourself if you don't want to go back. We did a story at Time a few months ago about how George Clooney and Matt Damon have a private satellite focused on one particular part of the South Sudanese border, and they're just watching one bad guy. This is inconceivable to us even a decade ago. Talk to me a little, if you can, about where the edge of innovation is in that field and what's happening. And what are you excited about, even though I know you're at a bit more of a remove than you were before?
Well, I think what's, to me, the most interesting thing about satellite imaging these days is, thanks to the Internet, we have these images available to just everybody. And so the ability to sort of crowdsource the analysis, that's what's really new. I mean, the satellite images that we get today aren't dramatically different in character in general than what we got 5 or 10 years ago. And so that's in some sense very different from the smartphones we have today are dramatically different from the smartphones we had 5 or 10 years ago. But what we have today, which is very different, is the ability to engage with and interact with this information in this pooled manner. And so one of the fascinating aspects of creativity and innovation generally, not just with respect to satellites, but it applies to satellites, is this ability to crowdsource and to collaboratively do things on just incredible scales, sort of this, you know, collaborative innovation that can involve not teams of 5 people, but 5,000 people or 500,000 people. And satellite imagery is one way where we've seen some really, really interesting uses of the data, but one of only many, of course.
Okay. I have many more, but I don't want to. This panel can be crowdsourced itself, and it would be foolish to leave all the analysis in one person's hands. So I'm going to take a risk here and bet that someone wants to ask either of our panelists something. You can direct it to either John. Just don't direct it to me. Yes, sir.
Yes, my name is Don.
Yes.
That's great. My name is Donald Barnes. I'm from South China University of Technology in Guangzhou, China. We noticed in the news this week about the water pollution that has taken place in the past in Camp Lejeune, and the paper yesterday or today about the lead in the D.C. water. Do you envision a time when we would have a mobile device where we could test our water before we drink it?
I'm sure that it's possible. It's a little high tech for the work that we do, which is really around basic service delivery. But there are increasingly very sophisticated water technologies out there. If you go to any of these, the World Water Forum, for example, the kind of technology that exists now to analyze what's in water is incredible. However, those technologies remain super expensive. So to do it on the household level, I think would still be, there's a long time before that's going to happen. What we are trying to find is ways to do basic water quality analysis for much cheaper. So, for example, that's one of the weaknesses that we've identified in our monitoring with mobile phones, is that we don't do a good enough job on actually looking at the water quality in all of these points that we've put in place over the years. And so what we're now doing is looking at, and there's actually a $5 kit now that you can actually have that will be, that you can test the water to get basic, not these heavy metals or these types of things that you're talking about, but the basic, make sure that the water is healthy enough to be drinking.
Something about that question had made me thirsty. I don't know what it was.
I know. Thank you.
Someone else? In the back.
Hello, Pat Austria from the World Bank. So I was wondering, we can all agree that there are so many inventions out there, but are there any problems or challenges with having invention become so rampant? For example, less collaboration or the truly game-changing inventions aren't rising to the surface because there's so many coming out?
I think that's a great question. I think generally rampant invention is a good thing. Right, you'd want to have. In fact, I would argue that it's a necessary thing, right? In order to have the 5 or 10 or 100 incredible inventions, you're probably going to have a few thousand that are pretty good, and a few tens of thousands that maybe don't matter as much. But I think it creates very real on the ground challenges for organizations like national patent offices, right? So if you're the USPTO, then you're charged with this incredible incoming flood of patent applications, and it is a very, very difficult job to really understand which one of those deserve patent protections and which one of them don't. So I think there are burdens there. I'd also say that the market does play a role, not always a perfect role, but in general a positive role in helping to select, right? So people who invent something and then start a company, and if they really are meeting a market demand and market need, the world isn't perfect. It doesn't mean that, there's 100% correlation, but there is a correlation. So I think the market plays a good role in helping to sift out the value of inventions. But rampant invention is a good thing. We certainly don't want to reduce innovation.
Now that we've established that we have it, because I was going to ask you if it was accelerating. It was my impression that it was accelerating. Now that we've, I think, established that it is, can you just talk a little bit more, John, about why, dig a little deeper into the reasons? I was pretty general at the top as about computational and educational and regional barriers. But is there other factors that we need to just put on the table here that explain the word rampant, which I thought was great?
Well, I think there's a general folks may disagree, but I think there's a general global move towards entrepreneurship. I think there's a greater appreciation of the value of entrepreneurship, in really almost every country in the world, and really almost an inevitable consequence of being an entrepreneur is thinking about what can you do that's new and innovative to satisfy a market need, or perhaps even create a market where there wasn't one, and then meet that new market that you've created, which is sort of what happened with personal computers. So. I think that leads to increased interest in creating.
And it also sounds to me like that there is a personal motivation at work here in invention. It's not merely curiosity. There's also an element of this which is just individual ambition.
Yeah, I think that's, and I agree, and that's not, of course, new. We've had that. You know, Thomas Edison was famously, in fact, in the Time magazine article on the Qualcomm Time Survey, you talked about that quite a bit. And, that's always been a key driver. You know, ambition to create something, to create something new,
as well as hard work
and luck,
trial
sleep.
And error.
Right. So as
luck,
as we learned from that article, Thomas Edison didn't sleep very much. Right.
It's quite something. Other questions? Yes, sir. In here.
Hi, I'm Fred Altman. I'm retired. And one of the big advantages of all the mobile phones is you're able, or mobile devices, is you're able to gather tons of data. But to make that useful, there needs to be a lot of analysis. And we've gotten to the point with big data, et cetera, and analyzing it. And our... is the back end, the analysis end, getting as much attention as the front end, the mobile devices themselves?
I think you get that one.
Okay. Well, yeah, it's a great question. Big data is recognized as one of the preeminent challenges of the time. I think it is getting a lot of attention. That said, there's an enormous amount more to do. And I would say that we've seen some great examples already. I mean, for example, I've read that people are able to use, for example, internet search queries to figure out where there are clusters, perhaps, of disease outbreaks, right, which would have been, you know, impossible to find out years ago. And, of course, the U.S. government has funded and is funding some major initiatives built around big data. But it's an incredibly hard problem. If you read any of these statistics about the amount of data being created, and there are these stunning things like, you know, every week there's enough data created that you'd have to, if it was HDTV, you'd have to watch it for a gazillion years. I mean, it's just incredible. So I'm sure that we're leaving a lot on the table in terms of information that, were we able to know how to get there and look at it, we'd be able to figure things out. But good people are working on it, and that's an opportunity for innovation and invention right there, is big data analysis.
If I can just jump in, I think it is about tracing it back to what is the impact that you're trying to solve in some particular area, and then making sure that you're using that data to actually make decisions and improve what you're doing versus just having the data. Because I think that's a big question that, you know, we see in the international development space a lot, is we've got a lot of data on what governments are doing, you know, what money they're spending, but are we taking that a step further and saying, okay, we're trying to reduce global poverty here. How are we really using that data to help us make decisions, whether we're on track or off track in that area, and make the necessary improvements to get better?
And John Sauer, what else, how do we ensure that the rampant innovation that we're talking about here doesn't just run to developed nations and developed nations' problems? So much of what we think about in this realm is about technology and is about, rightly or wrongly, consumer technology. Since we're bombarded by all the new things we can do with all of our devices, how do we make sure that the inventive culture extends to problems that most of us don't have, things we take for granted, that other people in other places have in rampant scale without so many of these other wonderful technological assists that we've got grown accustomed to? How do we make sure that the policies about that sort of are designed to foster invention actually treat problems that we really don't have but other folks do?
I think that would make a great Time magazine story, actually. No, but the reality is that we do need to look at, you know, how those inventions are. I think it's around, we have to rethink actually how we're doing international development, because it's got to not be about, you know, the infrastructure first per se, but about facilitating this type of effort to happen. So I look at our own role at Water for People. You know, 10 years ago, all we were doing was putting boreholes in the ground in communities. Now our role is much more around facilitating to build the capacity amongst district governments so that they can spend the money that national governments have and do monitoring too as well. But that's a big step change. And I think that's the kind. So it's really around that facilitation role. So how do we do things like support more entrepreneurship development, you know, to solve certain challenges? We're doing that with, that's what we're doing, for example, with sanitation is we're doing a lot of work to bring new entrepreneurs into the sanitation space where if we weren't doing that, no one else is focusing on that. So it is around, I think, rethinking how we do international development overall, because I think that the way we've done it hasn't gotten the results that we want, and that's about better monitoring to understand that, but it's also then about that role of facilitation, I think, versus doing direct implementation.
Can you talk about maybe one success story where you've actually identified an entrepreneur or at least an area where you think that you've had some success in getting from idea to application?
One of the inventions in this space has been this device called the Gulper, which is actually a bilge pump essentially for pit latrines, because in a lot of the informal settlement areas you can't get in a exhauster truck or a cesspool truck. You know, they're too big, they don't fit down the narrow alleyways. So we've actually developed this innovation or this invention, let's say, called the Gulper. Then entrepreneurs can now take this device and empty someone's pit latrine so that it can continue to be used and it doesn't continue to pollute the environment. So I think, you know, again, that's very low tech, but it's an important invention. And it's allowed these businesses, we've got, you know, several of these in the few countries that we work in Africa that are quite successful.
And where did it come? Can you talk a little bit more about its provenance? How it
The Gulper itself? So,
bilge pump that you.
It's a bilge pump.
It's a souped up bilge pump.
For poop, yeah.
It's a glamorous topic. We're going to stay with this as long as we can.
Again, a good Time magazine article. Something on shit would be nice.
Did it start here, or was it someplace else?
It started, I believe, in Tanzania was where it first got its footing. One of my colleagues who I work with, he was at the London School of Economics at the time. I think he started to see this need that all these pits were full, and he started to say, okay, how do we, you know, and he's got a lot of friends that are engineers, so he came up with a bilge pump for this issue. So it did come locally more, but you know, he's a Brit, but still, it was definitely developed to meet a local need.
One thing I can add just to the question about stimulating invention globally, not just in the developed economies, is I think intellectual property systems play a really important role in that, and so. I think you're seeing more and more in developing countries a recognition of the need to put into practice strong intellectual property protections. And I think when that happens, I think there's a direct correlation between confidence that your invention will in fact be protectable, and then you know the energy invested and the money invested to create inventions. So I think that's all moving in a very positive direction, and that's an important component as well.
I don't think the Gulper has a patent, by the way.
I knew that when we started down this alley, we might end up there, but I thought this panel needs to get down to the weeds of the problems. Yes, sir.
Does mobile evidence from mobile users who might be providing sort of in feedback on the quality of services, do you think that can play a role in sort of breaking down some of those barriers to entry?
So your first question, no, we don't. In the countries that we're working in, we don't see any resistance. In fact, the public utilities are very excited to work with us on this because they know that they cannot address this problem themselves, and they're quite good partners, to be honest. And clearly, we would the end goal is we would love it for everyone to have a connection to a sewage, and that's what we're aiming for, but I think the reality is that that's very costly, so we need some other types of solutions. We need, you know, perhaps decentralized systems. We need some of this. We still need these other entrepreneurs to play the role that they're playing. So no, we don't see any resistance from the public sector. In fact, they're quite keen partners. And your second question was, I think my answer would be yes, there definitely is a role to play, and we're already doing that. We are using mobile technology to do surveys and also engaging in customer feedback, which at this point is a little bit more qualitative, but I think there's, going forward, there probably will be a need or it will be valuable to do a bit more of that on a wider scale. So I think the answer is yes, the mobile can for sure play a role in that.
Obviously, government funding and backing has had a role in some great big inventions in our history.
The internet.
Right. Just to pick one. but it's also true that perhaps the government can get in the way. Can you just give us your take on whether we have the mix right now?
I think we're doing a pretty good job. Government has played a really incredibly important role and is continuing to do so. I think it's hard for anyone, I think, to say, do we have the mix right now? Because I think the internet was the first message was sent, I believe it was 1969, I may be wrong about that, but it was about then. Now, if we had a panel like this in 1971 and you'd said, hey, is the government doing the right things? I wouldn't have been able to say, hey, we got the internet 2 years ago. You know, we wouldn't have known yet. And so, in some sense, the answer of whether we're doing the right things today is not going to be obvious for, we don't know, really. But all indications are that, you know, this country continues to enjoy a very healthy mix of government funding for research that then creates, in many cases, innovations and sometimes specific patentable inventions. And of course, a robust private sector with venture capital investments and investments made by companies like Qualcomm reinvesting their revenues into inventive activities and so on. So I think the mix, you can always tune it a little bit, but it's in general, I think it's working quite well.
You opened the door there, John. Sorry. If you had the dial on your dashboard and you could turn one up, one thing, or one or two things there, what would you turn up or turn down? You can go any way you want.
No, I think you know, the system isn't fundamentally broken. I do worry... since you brought it up, I do worry there is a growing, in some sense, anti-intellectual property climate among some quarters, and I worry that the pendulum can swing too far against intellectual property rights, and you know, if that gets reflected in you know, well-intentioned legislation that could then impede innovation, that could be a concern as well. So that climate is out there, and I sometimes worry that the balance could be changed.
Okay.
Could I jump in? You asked before about how can we get some of these inventions to shift into developing countries where the problem is. And I think the role of government in that, and it kind of piggybacks on the other gentleman's question, is really important. And I think that's another area that we could try to perhaps advocate or shift or support by getting the governments yes, they have the regulatory role to play, but on the other hand, playing a more active role, not in doing the invention themselves, but actually in supporting, providing good market intelligence or supporting, providing incentives so that the private sector can do research and development in those countries, I think would be a really good role for the government to play, and one that's been advocated by WSP, actually, which is the Water and Sanitation Program at the World Bank, in a recent report on innovation and needs in the sector. So I think what the roles are important, and that would help do, as you said, get this moving.
If I can just add to that, I think, you know, in some of these developing countries, just because, for example, the number of patent filings may not be as high, doesn't mean there's not an incredible innovation and invention going on. We're doing a project through the World Economic Forum related to the informal IP and the informal economy, and actually this one's focused on India. And so there's, you know, of course, people in India aren't any less creative or inventive than people anywhere else, and you know, just because we, you know, they might not be represented with issued patents or mm-hmm. or trademarks and things like that. There's still just an incredible amount of innovation in all of these places. So the question is really not getting it to happen, but it's really sort of harnessing it and making sure it's properly incentivized and captured and valued.
Okay, well, we're nearly out of time, and I do get the last question, unless this doesn't take up the time. But since this is for me particularly a day of summing up the year, as best I'm able, and doing so arbitrarily, I'm going to ask both of my colleague panelists a question I didn't prepare them for, and I'll just give them. I'm going to ask them in a minute to think up what they think their most important invention that or application or innovation that they have seen this year in whatever field they want to pick, and it can be theoretical or practical. I'm just give you a few more minutes to think about that while I talk for about. I just think I need to vamp for 30 seconds or so you have an answer, because this is an excellent time at the end of the week. We have the mini gadgets of the year series you can download and best movies and all sorts of things. But I'm hoping that in a panel of intervention in the middle of December, we both of you can just share with us one thing that you didn't have or didn't know about or hadn't. Weren't excited about it at the beginning of the year, that as the year closes, you have great hope and prospect for. So,
I got one.
Good.
one of my colleagues in engineering at UCLA is a professor named Adagon Ozkan, and what he's done is he has, and I don't know if that's actually this year, but he's gotten a lot of attention this year, he's come up with methods to use the imagers, the cameras and cell phones and mobile phones to do mm-hmm. medical diagnostic testing. And that's getting incredible traction in the developing world, because you have, you know, these devices that can be used to test for these diseases. And again, this is one of these, who would have known 20 years ago that this was out there? So to me, that's an example of this. It's just an incredible invention that can, you know, has the potential to save just innumerable lives and make a real difference using something people already own.
Yeah, camera phones can do some pretty incredible things. Like, they can count the number of fecal coliform in a petri dish now, so you don't have to count them yourself. You just take the picture, and the camera will count it and tell you, you know, if your water is safe to drink or not.
Is that a this year development?
No, it's not. So I just was
piggybacking.
I did. No, so this is something that I just learned about recently, but there's an interest, you know, it goes back to this collective decision making that I think is really critical and important. There's a software or a company called Lumio that has developed this kind of collaborative decision-making platform that I just learned about recently, and that I think could be very exciting. We haven't used it yet, but I think I'm going to use it for a project I'm working on right now.
How would it exactly go, do you think? How would it work?
So the way that it works is that you collaborate with a group of people, and, you know, we could do this throughout, you know, we'll do it with people in Uganda and Denver and, you know, in the Netherlands, and, you know, and it helps you just to make decisions about where you're working with on programming, on projects. It gives you a way to sort of flag whether, if there's a priority, and then when you want to take a discussion to some kind of actual decision making piece and create the team to actually make some decisions around that. So you can actually do all this virtually without having to have a meeting or send a 25 emails. And I think it's I haven't looked at it too much, but it's quite
it's a heuristic platform.
Yeah.
Well, great. We'll need that, I'm sure, the next time we meet. But for now, we have done our best to give you a tour d'horizon of the of invention in the year 2013 and where we think it's headed. We appreciate your participation. We're going to yield to panel two now. I'm not quite sure how we're going to yield to panel two. off we go. Thank you.
Don't walk away with your mic, then.
So our next panel is going to look at changing models of service delivery. So we're going to look at some specific examples of cool new things that are taking place, but also think more generally about ways to facilitate those types of changes in the future. So we have three leading thinkers in this area. Zia Yusuf is the CEO of Streetline Incorporated, a leading global provider of sensor-enabled smart city solutions. He is a seasoned senior technology executive with a track record of leading companies to success. Prior to his role leading Streetline, he was entrepreneur in residence at Sutter Hill Ventures and also Norwest Venture Partners. He spent the last 10 years at SAP AG, where he was executive vice president and a member of SAP's executive leadership team. Kinfield Griffin is the CEO of Mobile Surveys Incorporated. M Survey represents mobile surveys that operate in Africa, the Caribbean, as well as the United States. He has a background in computer science, architecture, and engineering. He was educated at MIT, and he is assisted with the engineering and design of M Survey's technology. He discovered that in many emerging markets, they are somewhat constrained by the lack of access to information, and so this approach is something that enables the use of better information in the decision-making process. Stephen Livingston is professor of media and public affairs and international affairs with appointments in the School of Media and Public Affairs and the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. His research focuses on media and information technology as well as global politics. He's particularly interested in the role of information technology in governance and economic development. He is the co-editor with Gregor Walter Drop of a new Oxford University Press book entitled Bits and Atoms, Information and Communications Technology in Areas of Limited Statehood. And it looks at how mobile telephony and digital platforms enable community groups and NGOs to provide public goods in the developing world. So I'm going to start with Zia. So Streetline uses sensors to enable various types of smart city solutions. I know one of your goals is to improve parking. Welcome to Washington, D.C. We could use that solution here. How can mobile help people with parking problems?
So has anybody ever had a trouble finding a parking spot? So you're all potential customers. First of all, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. I just flew in on the red eye from San Francisco and thought because of the snow I'd never get here, and this seems to be this window of opportunity. So glad to be here. So Streetline is, believe it or not, in the business of parking. It's an industry that hasn't really changed in the last 30, 40 years. You still have coin-operated meters. In D.C. now you have kind of mobile payments and so on, but you search for a parking spot in all of these things. And we looked at this problem from a number of different angles, one from the perspective of a city. Parking is a massive real estate asset in a city environment. It's not priced appropriately. It's not allocated appropriately. So we go out and put out these sensors on the ground. The sensors detect the presence of a car. All that data and information then goes to city officials for them to do things like dynamic pricing, to be able to manage those spaces and think about it in a much more strategic way. And in the previous panel, they talked about the Internet of Things and sensors. So that's one piece of it. In addition, that information, very importantly, also goes to consumers. So we're able to tell you exactly where the open parking spots are on your smartphone, eventually, actually pretty quickly, in in-car navigation as well. And so what would a mobile panel be without a demo here? So this is I'm just going to show you Boston. We just announced Boston yesterday. So in this part of Boston, at this very second, there's 51 parking spaces. This is around the convention center. And this is all on street. And if you click that open, it shows you where the number of spaces are. So this is happening this very second in Boston. I can show you Birmingham. I can show you parts of New York, Fort Lauderdale, and so on. And so it shows you, if you know, what we're trying to impact is that decision point when you get to an intersection, right? You get to that intersection, you take a left, you take a right, you go straight. You're arguing with your spouse, you know, where do you want to go? So we help marriages as well. So it's a and so what we'll be able to tell you is, look, don't take a right. There's less than two spots there. You may find something, but highly unlikely. Take a left. where there's either 2+ or 4+, you're guaranteed to find parking. Mm-hmm. Up to 30% of the traffic in a city is caused by people looking for parking, believe it or not. It's a massive drain on the resources of a country. Historically, everybody's focusing on traffic. It takes you 14.2 minutes to get from point A to point B. And there'll be a lot of PhDs working on this, and they'll get it down to a precise 13.9 seconds. The problem is point B is not your destination. If your destination was the Brookings Institute and you kind of drove by here, you're like, hey, I'm here. It's at 14.2 minutes. Your real destination is point C when you've parked the car. And it's that second piece of the puzzle that nobody focused in on. So at the end of the day, this is all about, you know, you can talk about new data, you can talk about big data. It's about generating new types of information that wasn't possible before, in this instance through the case of sensors, and we'll, you know, add other sensing devices as we go along. And this kind of silly example of parking, which, you know, when I started doing this, going and having a cocktail conversation saying, I'm the parking industry, that was a great conversation. It's like, do you park cars? Do you valet? But it's very sophisticated technology, and it's changing how kind of cities will be run, because everybody's realized it has such a massive impact on the economy. It's usually the second or third largest source of revenue for a city, which most people don't realize. Yeah. So that's what we do. And you couldn't do it without the mobile piece of it, right? Whether it's the smartphone, whether it's the in-car piece of it, whether it's a Google map, whether you make a restaurant reservation with OpenTable, and then you can eventually go reserve a spot in garages as well. So it's kind of connecting those pieces, and it's the mobile technology piece of it that actually gets all that information out.
Interesting. I know in D.C., before they moved to this mobile payment system, which has been great, you literally used to have to carry around bags of quarters because you point out it's a major source of revenue. So, of course, they were raising the rates, but yet they still were using parking meters. And so that just kind of illustrates the nature of the problem. So, Kinfield, you work on a different aspect. You've noted that in emerging markets in the developing world, that countries often lack mechanisms to provide feedback and help decision makers take advantage of available information. So you've developed what you call the SurveyMonkey for emerging markets. How are you using information to improve decision making?
Well, thanks for having me again. I mean, this happened to me when I was doing my PhD at MIT, when I was actually walking around, you know, these low-income areas in Kenya. And, you know, even though I look Kenyan, you know, I'm not Kenyan, I'm from the Caribbean. So knocking on someone's door just to ask them a question or three questions, you know, taking up their time is very difficult. And, you know, we take it for granted that data is something that's, you know, ubiquitous everywhere, but it's not, especially in Kenya and in the Caribbean where I'm from. And I'll give you three examples. For instance, in Trinidad and Tobago, you know, they have the Telecommunication Authority of Trinidad and Tobago has $20 million U.S. dollars to invest in infrastructure in the Caribbean when it comes to mobile. But they don't know, with 140% mobile penetration, who has access to what are they using this access for, and who has internet on their mobile phones. So that's why we found it very interesting for us to use that portal to get data, to see where the points are, where limited access to actually invest the $20 million U.S. dollars. And I'll give you another example with the HIV/AIDS in some high-risk communities in Kenya. Dr. Habera, who sits in MGH, you know, she travels back and forth to Kenya a lot, and the problem with that is, you know, carbon emissions also is just a fact of time. You know, she wants to assess high-risk communities and understand exactly what their patterns are over a period of time. So what we did, they use our technology to assess HIV/AIDS patients. So every patient that comes into the hospital, they register on our platform, and every day they get a survey that they time. So if, you know, I want to get a survey, I say 2,100 hours, and I get that survey every day. It changes the pattern of behavior. You know, so now people are reporting what happens during their time. So Harvard just recently did a study saying that the best time for you to get valid data is at the front line. So don't wait till 2 weeks later to ask someone, how did I serve you? You know, ask them right then when you serve them. So it's best for them to remember when the last time they engaged in sexual activities. And then the third one, I mean, is agriculture. In Kenya specifically, most of our work is in East Africa. We're scaling to West Africa and now in the Caribbean. But there are farmers throughout Kenya that they are milk farmers. They produce about a market value of $3,500 of milk a year. Brookside Farms, who actually buys that, they have no database of these farmers. They have no connection. So these farmers want to improve their yield. You know, and Brookside wants to actually implement facilities to improve that yield, but they don't know the distribution of these farmers throughout Kenya. So we registered 14,000 farmers for them in 3 days on our technology. Now they interact with these farmers over time, and if you can do the math, 3,500 times 14,000, that's a lot of revenue for Brookside Farms. And if they improve that yield, you're improving the profits of that farmer as well as the profits of Brookside. So this is how information is used to make decisions that change people's lives in emerging markets. And it's not, you know, I've heard a lot of conversation about big data. I'm talking about little pieces of data. You know, just, you know, how many cattle do you have? You know, that's enough to inform what's the potential yield of milk, right? So this is the types of things we do.
Thank you. So, Stephen, your new book looks at how mobile empowers community groups and NGOs to provide public goods in the developing world. And I know you've done lots of work in Africa, in India, as well as other places. What does innovation look like in the developing world as opposed to the developed world?
Well, first of all, Daryl, thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to come and share these ideas with you. It's good to be back at Brookings. I've had the good fortune over the last 10 years or so to travel to about 40 countries looking at the impact, disruptive impact, sometimes positive, sometimes not, of technologies in Africa, India, as you said, Iraq, Afghanistan. And one of the things that I'm struck by is simply the change in the sense of social relationships, political relationships in communities that before were fairly isolated. I think one of the things that we have to do in order to begin to get our heads around, our arms around the enormity, the impact of something as simple as the mobile phone, is to keep in mind that in 2000, approximately 2% of Africans had access to telephones, and most of those, of course, were landline. The last figure that I've seen most recently paid attention to is 63% of Africans in 2012 now have access to mobile telephony. One of my favorite photos, in fact, it's on the cover of the book that Daryl mentioned, is of a Maasai standing in the middle of the savannah holding very proudly two things, his punga, his machete on the hip, but also right next to it is a mobile phone. And what that empowers is just unimaginable, and so it's important for us to just spend some time thinking about that. There are some technologies and applications that are unfamiliar to most of us in the North, so in the global North. So when we talk about mobile phones, we also have to think about the fact that mobile telephony is just one element in an integrated constellation of systems. This example here uses something called GIS and GPS as well, probably, as mobile telephony. It's the integration of these systems that's so important for us to understand how they truly impact a farmer living in a rural area in Kenya. So some of the technologies that piggyback onto or enable cellular telephony to be powerful, we may not have heard of, but they're important. Frontline SMS and rapid SMS are texting aggregation platforms that allow for the mass either management of text messaging messages coming in from phone users or the distribution of text messaging going out to users. And this is used all over the place. I'll come to an example that fits very well. You know, we need to keep in mind also, too, that remote sensing satellite imagery and remote sensing data are a crucial part of this equation. The first high-resolution commercial, not government, but commercial remote sensing satellite called Iconos went aloft in 1999, became operational in 2000, and has been joined by a constellation of other remote sensing satellites. This is another part of a constellation of technologies that come together to make the mobile telephony so important. And then when we start to think about some of the key applications, we can tick down many of the examples. Certainly M-Survey is going to be one of them. But in the Global South, there are others. The Grameen Foundations, community knowledge workers, simply empowers farmers who hold cell phones in very remote areas to serve as liaisons in terms of best practices for raising a crop. Another example beyond the community knowledge workers is something called Trade at Hand. I mean, the description fits the purpose. It gives farmers information on the daily commodity price quotes. Imagine that you are a farmer raising coffee somewhere in rural Rwanda. Somebody shows up, asks you to buy your coffee. If you aren't empowered with information as to what the daily price fluctuations are on that key commodity that needs to feed your family for the entire year, you're likely to be taken advantage of. But if you have that information in your hand, you are empowered to communicate on a more level playing field with that intermediary, with that buyer. Another technology that is possible because of mobile telephony in Africa and elsewhere, any conversation shouldn't miss this, but the revolutionary effect of something called M-Pesa. M-Pesa is responsible, according to a recent study, of one-third of Kenya's gross domestic product last year. What is it? M-Pesa is simply, pesa means money in Swahili. It means mobile money transfer. When you travel around Kenya, as I know that my colleagues know, you will find M-Pesa signs and stands where if you don't have currency, you can use your phone to pay for a service, a commodity, healthcare, education, or simply food stock. If you are a merchant with a small little hut somewhere in a rural village, rather than getting on the matatu, the bus, going to Nairobi, buying stock, bringing it back, you get on your phone, you buy the stock, use M-Pesa, it's delivered on the next matatu that arrives, you get your stock, you sell it, and the exchange itself is based on M-Pesa. So these are the ways in which mobile telephony are empowering communities, and this is just the start. There are hundreds and hundreds of examples of this sort of thing that we could list. So, you know, this is some of the things that I've been trying to pay attention to in my books and in my writing and travel and thinking and teaching. So,
I like the image of the machete on the one hand and the mobile device on the other.
They're both cutting-edge technologies.
Yes.
Thank you, John.
Hey, just consider me your stand-up person. So, Zia, you mentioned that the sensors represent a big growth area. We're seeing kind of a rise of machine communication. And so you're focusing on parking. So I'm curious, when you developed this application, what barriers did you experience and how did you overcome them?
On the technology side, there's certainly our sensors last 4.5 to 5 years on 2 AA batteries, for example, lithium batteries. The sensing technology is getting better and better, and we're doing some work with Qualcomm on looking at some of that sensing capability. So there's just the physics of sensors and the economics of sensors you have to kind of get them out there. But I think our biggest challenge, honestly, is not the technology piece. It's the exciting process of selling to municipalities and cities. Which can be quite exciting and sometimes...
Is this exciting in a good way or a bad way?
In a very respectful way. So it's the business model. It's incredible, and I spend a lot of time now with mayors and city officials and so on and so forth, but it's incredible how much new technology is available to rethink cities. This whole topic of smart cities across the board, and whether it's in community participation or getting information to that, you know, old man or old lady who doesn't have to stand out in the snow and they know when their bus is coming, and there's a whole range of examples. And I think city leaders, and I think mayors is, by the way, the most exciting kind of political role in the country today. If you're a mayor and you're forward looking, you can change how people work and live, which will not happen from the federal government side. So it's that, how does the purchasing and procurement process for cities and the federal government change in order to take advantage of these massively new technologies? So it's more on that go-to-market side, if you will, and less so on the technology side. The technology side is getting, I mean, it's just unbelievable the kind of things that are possible now. And this whole topic of the Internet of Things, which is mentioned, is going to be, and you look at GE and you look at Cisco and Qualcomm and all these companies, The only way to make an inanimate object smart is to put software in it. I used to work at SAP, as you mentioned. I think Siemens has 28, 30,000 software engineers. SAP probably has 15 or 18. You know, who's a software company? So you're having these, I mean, I think every company in essence has become a software company, whether you're selling shoes or vegetables or cars or trains or automobiles. And so this Internet of Things making sensors smart is going to have a much bigger impact on how all of us, again, work and live every day than even the Internet did. And so, by the way, just one comment. It seems like we didn't plan this, but we have East Africa and Kenya in common. I also, on my side, kind of teach at Stanford, in the Stanford Design School, mm-hmm. a class called Liberation Technology, mm-hmm. which is looking at the use of mobile technology in cooperation with the University of Nairobi mm-hmm. For economic development.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of the low-tech version of mobile, like M-Pesa, and you don't have smartphones, but the mobile coverage rate, even for feature phones, is very high. Yeah. And in places like Kibera, which is, you know, outside Nairobi, I mean, I think it's more than 80, 90% of mobile information. And it's the democratization of information, mm-hmm. which is unbelievable.
So, Kenfield, you were, you know, we hear a lot about big data. You were mentioning the value of little data mm-hmm. In the healthcare area, in agriculture, and elsewhere. Now, I know you're interested in using MSurvey to provide feedback so that we can get better decisions. We also know in a lot of countries around the world, people are not particularly interested in getting feedback. Mm-hmm. And so I'm just curious, when you have started to market this in the private sector, in the public sector, and elsewhere, how have people responded to it? And in cases where the public sector has adopted it, how has it affected the relationship between people and public officials?
That's an interesting question.
Thank you.
So, yes, to begin with, there was an issue with folks having a problem with, you know, hearing the truth. And I think now on the public and private sector, both, I mean, there's a lot of competition coming into emerging markets. And how do you, you know, avoid competition or beat your competition is knowing your customers and knowing your constituents. So I think that also pushes the envelope to getting feedback. And on the public side, I mean, because of economies right now are struggling from a financial perspective, and people are looking for that impact investment rather than just, oh, I'm going to provide you donor funds to do X, Y, and Z. They're looking to see exactly, you know, what's the end of that equation, you know, what's coming out of that, the result. So I think just pushing that envelope or pushing that the agenda of private sector, knowing that competition is there, you need to beat the competition, and public sector knowing that you're not going to get funding if you don't show the impact that you're having with my money, I think that actually helps us a lot. And now it's actually becoming more and more necessary for folks to actually have that data to prove, even just to write a grant. You know, they do a baseline survey to show exactly this is the problem. Now I need, you know, X amount of dollars to invest in this problem, and this is going to be the result. And we'll do another survey again on MSurvey to show you the result. So now we're capturing them at the beginning and the end of the whole cycle. So, and obviously, you know, we look at it as a design problem. Anything we look at as, you know, a product to, you know, a policy. You know, how you design a policy without feedback loops. You know, it's a very iterative process. You know, you're not going to just design, you know, policy and say, hey, it's going to work. You need that constant feedback to iterate and develop something that's sustainable over time. So people are learning that, and it's something that you have to also educate as well as show them the use, you know, as far as how the data can be useful and how it can give them a competitive advantage. And I think that's the type of language we've actually started using to show the value.
Okay. So, Stephen, you were mentioning the importance of system integration, and we know there's a lot of cool stuff, cool technology, cool applications, and so on, but you are suggesting that integrating this is a challenge so that we can actually get the benefits. So I'm curious what you have seen as you've traveled around to these 40 different countries and what lessons can be learned on the best way to do this.
Yeah, you know, thank you. I wouldn't really call it a challenge as much as a tremendous opportunity. Mm-hmm. So Let me give you an example. Nigeria has had a history of challenging elections. There's a challenge. And the last presidential and gubernatorial election was monitored by several platforms that utilized the widespread availability of mobile telephony, mobile phones. It's something called, one of them is called Reclaim Niger. And what Reclaim Niger did was it and a lot of it has to do with mobilizing communities. Various civil society organizations mobilized Nigerians through stickers, through wristbands, to give them a short number. That during the election process, if they saw something that they thought wasn't kosher, if you will, they could text that information in. Some 26,000 times that occurred during this election cycle. And what we've been able to, a colleague of mine and I were able to look at this process of mobile phones being used to geolocate, put these incidents on a map, to verify them in the process. They knew where they were. They had a good story in terms of what the nature of the problem was. All of these are various systems that come together to allow a level of transparency and accountability in an all-important elections process that helps give the government a degree of legitimacy that in the absence of this verification, good luck Jonathan may not have the position that he has for being understood as a president as a result of a fairly fair and free election. So this is how technology is being used by communities to empower not just for service provision, but for the provision of good governance. Mm-hmm. And you can find examples of that all over the world. And it's really quite inspiring.
So I'll throw out one last question for the whole panel, and any of you who want to jump in can do so, and then we'll open the floor to questions from the audience. And that concerns policy barriers. So each of you have worked in different places. You're working on different aspects of it. So Zia, you're kind of in the smart city area. Canfield, you're working on feedback devices. And Stephen, you're looking at political and economic development. What are the biggest policy barriers to making progress in this area, and are there particular provisions that you think would make a difference in enabling additional progress? Any of you who want to jump in? Hey, I could have asked, you know, what your favorite invention was for the year. But.
I mean, I think the biggest barriers, I think, is just understanding it. And I think it's more so a people thing. It's not a technology thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I think the technology is there. I think the intellect is there behind the technology. But the absence of knowing and how to utilize the technology and to take advantage of that is a big hurdle. And it's just, you know, aligning visions and aligning interest, I think, is a big issue. I mean, that's from my experience, and that's just very limited. Eh? So... I would say that's my...
No, that's important to point out.
I can maybe take a page out of my kind of venture capital book is allowing for, and maybe even celebrating, maybe that's a little too much, failure. Mm-hmm. As a public official, whether you're spending on a $10,000 project or a $10 billion project, $10 billion is clearly an issue, but there's this kind of fear that, oh my God, I can't get this wrong, which then leads to, in many cases, not all, obviously a very conservative outlook on what should be done. I think if you allow for more rapid experimentation with smaller amounts of money, so it's not a money thing, I think, and if you say, okay, I'm going to try five different things, I'm going to spend $20,000 on these five, and there's a potential that three of them don't work, but one or two of them could, I think that would make a big change.
Steven?
Yeah, in my case, you know, mostly I'm looking at the role of technology in my profession. I call it an area of limited statehood, a place where the state isn't found, slums, very rural communities. There is no state service provision. So in terms of policy impediments, it's the absence of policy. It's the absence of the state. But that leads to another problem. It's most often the case you've got more than one NGO trying to fill that governance vacuum, and there's a lack of coordination amongst the NGOs, you end up having a lot of replication of effort. I'm sure that M-Survey is terrific with its work with farmers, and I applaud that. I think the innovation is going to be great, but there's something else in Nairobi called M-Farm that does the same thing. So I would love to see a day when M-Survey and M-Farm compared platforms, came up with a common design, and worked together to enlist even more farmers, to facilitate even more strength within that sector. So Here the policy has to do with coordination amongst non-state actors.
Okay, let's open the floor to questions from the audience. We have somebody with a microphone back there. So just give us your name and your organization.
We've overwhelmed them.
And don't everyone speak at once? Here's a question. So we have a microphone coming up to you.
Hi, Fred Altman again. A couple of days ago, there was a session here. It was actually across the street as a working session on smart cities. And the one thing I heard is in terms of the people in responsible for setting them up is not to have an isolated, well, we'll do this project and over there we'll do another project, but sort of put all the money in a pot and approach the problem universally. Like instead of parking, the overall transportation problem. And I just wonder, as you sell your product, do you put it in the context of an overall transportation or some other overall scheme?
So can I ask you a question? Were these predominantly large companies that were saying this? Were they large companies or big institutions that made this comment?
This were mainly government officials.
Okay.
Metropolitan studies, so cities. Right.
So I unfortunately patently disagree with that. I think it's ridiculous. If you look at the history of these smart city projects, they generally have not resulted in smart cities. They've resulted in a lot of diagnoses, a lot of reports, a lot of conferences that this is what a grand smart city should look like. And then there'll be these big projects of 500, 600 million, 10 years, and so on. It's too much. It's just way too much. I think the opportunity is to actually take smaller slices of the pie, smaller verticals. So now we're trying to solve the problem of parking, and we will. Yeah, now, while all these other people are talking about changing the world and having kind of nice discussions on it, we're going and doing it, and we chose parking to go do it. In the same way, there are other technology companies, other small startups that are taking a piece of the puzzle and saying, I can solve this today. I'm not going to wait for what policy will change 10 years from now, 15. For me, long term is 3 months. You know, I'm on a budget. I'm running out of money. I can't think that far. So I have to produce something that people will use that I can sell that solves a problem today and next year. Now, having said that, at a certain point in time, those pieces need to come together. But yes, parking should be with a policy around, you know, transportation and freedom of people moving around. So there are these bigger issues. But if we just focus on these bigger issues, we'll never bloody get anything done. So I chose to, and other entrepreneurs that are attacking the smart city problem will say that the efforts in the last 20 years to create these kind of big plans have led to nothing. But now, also primarily due to mobile technology, due to the democratization of information, due to the sensor stuff, there are companies out there building smart garbage cans, you know, smart trucks, water pipes, and all of those things. And yes, there's some disconnected aspects to it, but it will come together.
Yeah, I was going to follow up on that.
I hope that was unambiguous in my career.
Well, I don't know if it was unambiguous for him, but I have a follow-up for you.
Yeah, sure.
In terms of the smart cities area, I mean, the applications that I've heard that seem to be most promising and a number of cities around the world have adopted have been one in the parking area, and then I think someone on an earlier panel mentioned the bus line situation where through a mobile device you can stand on a particular street corner and find when your bus is going to arrive there. I'm curious from your standpoint, what are the other promising areas?
Sure.
You know, there's been a lot of hype. Some have worked out. Some haven't worked out. What do you think other than parking and
sure,
buses?
Absolutely. So, in my view is that you take a look at specific what I call vertical use cases, right? So bus information, real-time bus information is one. Smart parking is one. The smart grid area and electricity management has been another one, which is a broader issue. Where now people starting to put things on sensors on garbage cans? Okay, so now if you kind of think about the microeconomics of this stuff, a garbage truck going around the city, going to garbage cans that are not full or quarter full, and making that whole, that stuff adds up. Okay? You put a sensor in a garbage can that tells you, oh, I'm only half full, don't pick me up today, move on. Those are the kind of those micro level topics that are important. Pollution sensors at a block level that starts to give you a sense of the microclimate at a block level. People can do that today. Sensors in fire hydrants. I don't know if you know, but a lot of time is spent by fire departments actually checking the water pressure in a fire hydrant. There's no reason to do that. A water pressure sensor is not rocket science. Getting that data out is a little bit tricky, but once you lay out a network, and Qualcomm and Cisco and other people are kind of looking at doing that, you can get that information out. So transportation is becoming a very, very interesting area, broadly speaking. Then you have things like Uber, which to me also is a very much a smart city type of service. And Uber, for those you don't know, you can use your smartphone and you can find a car or taxi. I mean, I took an Uber car from the airport this morning. That's completely reinventing how taxi services and transportation happens, where you're not waiting for something to go by, but that data and information, that thing in this case is a car. And the car is telling you, I'm here, I'm available, and you can avail yourself of it. So I think and you can look at healthcare, you can look at all these other things. There's a range of those that, delivery of social services. I mean, the ability to, you know, renew your damn license online instead of going in and standing in line for 4 hours. Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, technology could have done that 15 years ago. So that's.
Yeah, and in this city, I would add bike sharing has been.
Bike sharing has
well.
Been huge. I mean, you've got City Bike in New York. The head of transportation, Gabe Klein, who started the bike share here, he did the same thing in Chicago 6 months ago. That is a phenomenal innovation. And now with apps, you can find where the bike is, so you don't have to walk there and see 10 bike stations that are empty. So you can see where it is. You can pay for it. I mean, that's where the smart city will come from the ground up.
Okay, literally. Stephen, you were going to jump in?
Well, not to plug Uber, but Uber explains if you don't know what
you can
the
plug
cars,
them. I put
cars,
some money in, so plug them.
The cars with the mustaches in the front, if you've seen those and you've wondered what they are, those are the Uber taxis. But that's not what I want to talk about. I'm interested in trying to translate a conversation about smart cities into what I actually am involved in, a program called Smart Slums or Smart Informal Communities, where you're trying to leverage these mobile distributed technologies for purposes appropriate to people who aren't worrying about a parking place, but they're worried about where to find a bathroom or where to get clean water. There are many examples of this, but one that comes to mind is actually something that came to mind when John was speaking in the first panel. There is in India, in some of the informal communities or slums in India, a project being pursued by an NGO where the residents have a simple little like ATM card with not a lot of money on it, but they are able to use this card to get water out of a system that has sensors built into it in many different ways, in terms of whether it's operating, in terms of the water pressure, in terms of how often it's being used, et cetera. So building in these kinds of technologies into the Global South is what I think is really quite fascinating. Why? Because in the Global South, you don't have an alternative service provider. The state isn't often there to provide that service. It's not understood to be a viable market for corporations, so it's outside of the market solution set. So you're looking at ways of leveraging technology, taking the efficiencies that you find and providing services that are otherwise not there. One other fascinating example I just want to leave with, Google Earth Engine has a project that it's based on Android phones where communities in the Amazon, Indian communities in the Amazon, are doing carbon monitoring and tracking illegal logging in the Amazon. And this, again, it's very localized carbon monitoring being done by indigenous communities in the Amazon. So the reach of these technologies is terrific with finding parking places, but it goes so much further than that in the Global South.
And some places in Africa, I know they're using this technology to help endangered animals as
That's
well.
That's right. So, yeah.
Other questions? There's a gentleman right there on the aisle.
Good morning. I'm Emerson Brooking, intern here at Brookings. And I was curious, I read very recently that in early 2014, Twitter will be unveiling a skeleton version of their platform that operates entirely via SMS. And I was curious from your perspective whether companies like Twitter that are announcing functionalities like this, are they meeting a demand that exists now or anticipating a demand?
And this is addressed to me?
To you and to anyone else who'd like to answer.
Gentlemen.
So you're asking if they're meeting demand or anticipating a demand for SMS? Is that what you're asking?
No, for Twitter.
For Twitter? I mean, yeah, I mean...
Do you think SMS would be a viable niche?
Well, I mean, that's how Twitter started. Twitter started by SMS. I mean, that was... That's how
just to clarify, I'm curious whether, you know, there's an increasing use of mobile technologies in the developing world. Is the demand really for very local functionality, or is there an increasing push to be part of the global dialogue?
So I think, for me, the difference is between a smartphone and a feature phone, right? Facebook is having the same challenge in India and other parts of Africa. They cannot push out this fancy Facebook homepage onto a Nokia, you know, if Nokia still exists as a company, the Nokia feature phone, which is one of the most popular phones in the emerging markets. So what Twitter and Facebook and others are doing, they're kind of coming down the technology stack, if you will, and they have to do it for a certain period of time because the U.S. and Europe is saturated, right? And there's just so much you can, and it's a tiny piece of the population. So the billions of people are not in Europe and the U.S. And over the next 4, 5, 10 years, in order to get to those people, you can't sit there hoping that every one of them is going to have an iPhone and an Android phone. So you have to figure out how to deliver that type of capability through a feature phone. And the primary way to do that is through an SMS-type messaging system and not an application-based, you know, system. So that's why they're doing it. I mean, it's straightforward math.
I mean, for MSurvey, that's how we deliver our surveys, right, through SMS.
I mean, do you use Frontline or?
No, this is just our native. Yeah. We connect directly to the telcos, and we have agreements with the telcos. We're scalable across any region.
And same thing with M-Pesa. I mean, M-Pesa would not have gone, you know, anywhere if they waited for kind of a nice little user interface and buttons and so on. It works.
I think it's platform agnostic in a sense. I mean, SMS is across any platform that you can use. And I mean, specifically for us, we know we're looking to get, no one's going to download a survey app. I mean, that's just, that's never going to happen, right? So I mean, you have to meet them, you have to meet someone where they are. And SMS is a, you know, WhatsApp, it's no different from SMS. I mean, WhatsApp has over 300 million users because it's an easy integrated system that you can use. Everyone is very familiar with SMS, you know, so I think that's just meeting everyone how they use their mobile phones.
All of that's correct, except for I would say that by 2018, it's expected that 50% of the phones in Africa are going to be internet enabled. Mm-hmm. And when you spend time, as I do, in Nigeria, Kenya, Ghana, and South Africa, you find incredible growth in some of the social media that you'd be familiar with. Mm-hmm. So when we speak of what's going to happen there, we have to be very precise when we talk about where we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. Rwanda is another place that may surprise some of you that is really quite remarkable in its in the growth of internet-enabled telephony. So you have to look very specifically. I know that Facebook, one of the recent times I was in Nairobi, Facebook put on a big festival in the middle of the big public park in the middle of Nairobi. Tens of thousands of people were there celebrating. They had their phones. They were dancing. It was a terrific example of the reach of some of the kinds of technologies that you'd be familiar with in places that you'd be surprised perhaps to find.
Other questions?
John has one. Over here.
Oh. Yeah, we have a microphone coming up to you.
Stephen, you talked about the importance of collaboration and that's trying to avoid duplication. I'm wondering, could you give some examples of where you've seen that actually happen?
Yeah.
In developing countries or even here in the United States, but I'm kind of more interested in developing countries.
Yeah, so the question has to do with, do you see examples of collaboration amongst people who have like-minded interests, goals, objectives, maybe using different skill sets? Yeah, you see it in small ways. I mean, I could look at something called Spatial Collective, which works in Mathare, one of the slums in Nairobi, is working also with an NGO that has as its purpose abating some of the hate speech that one finds on text messaging platforms, especially leading up to the recent election in Kenya. So you have these scrappy, smaller NGOs that are coming together and trying to carve out a niche where they're solving really pressing problems. In my own experience, and it may be that this is just simply unique to me, where I sometimes see less collaboration, more competition, is where you get into the bigger boys and girls, where you have the larger NGOs that are all going after the same Gates Foundation, Ford Foundation, other foundation grants. And so any sort of collaboration, it's like competition within a business community. It's like McDonald's and Burger King collaborating. Probably isn't going to happen anytime soon, or should it? It's where you have that competition for funding that I see less collaboration.
And that was sort of my follow-up question was, where, you know, is this an issue actually of the funders? Do they need to do something differently to actually spur this collaboration versus this competition? Yeah. I mean, competition is not a. No, I'm not saying it's a bad thing. I actually think it's a very good thing. But
yeah.
I'm just saying, is there, who's going to fund these collective impact type of efforts? Because you see it starting to happen a little bit in domestically, but I haven't. It's been really hard to see it happen internationally. I think that's really the key of moving things forward and breaking down some of these cycles of failure, actually. So,
I don't have any direct response to that. You know, one of the things I guess indirectly I would say, however, is I'm really such a huge fan of innovation centers that are found all around the world. Some of them are sponsored by the Googles and the Microsofts of the world, right? But also there are the examples of iHub, again in Nairobi, where you have entrepreneurs, people who are interested in making money. They have an idea, but they also have a wonderfully collaborative spirit of working together often and solving common problems and coming together on particular projects, sitting in a sort of a communal space in an office building on the Yungong Road in Nairobi. Those are the places where you see the kinds of collaboration that I like.
I just wanted to comment also to, it's just these problems don't only persist in emerging markets. I mean, like for instance, in 2011, in the UK, it cost the UK £400 million to do the census. I mean, they're trying to just get rid of it because they don't know what to do. I mean, you have mobile phones, you have technologies that can actually circumvent that. You know, so I mean, and that's why we focus on what we do, which is surveys. I mean, mobile surveys. I mean, there is nothing as far as, I mean, the technology in the back end is innovative because it does real time analysis, but it's just surveys that have been around for, you know, since the 19th centuries, right? So I mean, these are problems that persist in developed countries as well. You know, how do you can actually reduce costs, you know, of counting people? You know, that comes back to the smart city problem, right? So,
okay, there's a question on the aisle there.
Yes, hi, Judith Hellstein, Hellstein Associates. You talked about sensors being put into roads in developing countries, or buildings, or infrastructure, or water facilities. And I guess my question is that oftentimes you've seen these items put in, and then they break, and there's no ability to fix them, or the government can't buy new ones, or there's some other issue, and then the whole technology is not being used. And what do you see? And that's why I was always leery about that type of going in that way. If we don't have an answer of how we're going to train people to get them fixed, or to buy them, or what, or that.
Sure. So I mean that in a prior life, I actually was living in D.C. and worked at the World Bank for about 6 years, and that's one of the broader issues around programs of any kind, whether it's technology or education or anything else, is the difference between building something first time and having a nice ribbon cutting ceremony and everybody takes a picture, and then 6 months later you don't have the capacity and the money to continue it forward. So I think that is a program design issue. I think now, because of globalization and the transparency of information and transparency of data around pricing and contracts and so on and so forth, there are ways to deal with that. You certainly, if it's a project that's designed that doesn't allow for an ongoing capability to operate, then it's a badly designed project in the first place. But if you can, I mean, there's certainly ways to do that. But that's a fundamental, I mean, issue. I mean, that's a problem in a lot of, I mean, you'll know more about this on international development projects where so many of these things are front-end loaded. And then, you know, teachers get paid for a year, nice building, and then where do you get the money for the second year? And mm-hmm. people are surprised, oh, where did the teachers go? Well, you didn't pay them.
Right here is a question.
I'm Donald Barnes, South China University of Technology. This all sounds very good, but what about the flip side of this? Is there any danger or possibility in the probability of governments or large corporations or something like this co-opting this whole field and taking advantage and control in such a way that we are being used rather than utilizing this technology?
Well, you just have to read the Washington Post today that I picked up from the airport that talking about what the NSA was doing on cookies and browsers and so on and so forth. Look, anytime you have software in anything, whether it's a device, whether it's on the internet, it's a door and it's a two-way door. There's no way to stop that. And you can have this continuous arms race of, you know, access and privacy and so on and so forth. Personally, I've given up on privacy. I mean, it's just, I'm concerned about financial privacy. So there's like, you know, 2-3 bank accounts where I'll make sure my few hundred dollars is okay. But other than that, you have no privacy. One concern I do have on the Internet of Things is that hackers getting into your Facebook password and so on is disturbing and socially challenging, but it's not going to necessarily kill anybody. A Google autonomous car that's chugging along down the street and somebody in some country decides to take it over and make a left turn and, you know, drive into a building, that if it's software, it can be done. And so I think there's an issue around the Internet of Things and hacking and access that, you know, people haven't talked about yet. And it's also, you know, there's been some incidences of people trying to take over autopilots on planes. That's another example of that. So if it's something's wirelessly connected, it has software in it, there's a little bit of excitement to be had there, and we'll have to kind of figure that out.
Actually, at Brookings, I think it was last year, we had a drone contest, and it turns out a lot of the software is open source software, and so one of the strategies that was used in this contest was to basically take down all the other drones, and they did it successfully.
Yeah, you can, but if somebody's built it, if a human being's built it, another human being can figure out how to unbuild it. That's the premise, right? And you had last week on 60 Minutes, Amazon, you know, Jeff Bezos talk about the Amazon Prime drones that are going to start delivering packages. Yeah, so if you have drones kind of flying around, first people are going to start, you know, shooting at them just for the hell of it. So that's, you have to solve that, throwing rocks at them. But then, you know, taking control of those drones. So that's, as software gets into more physical stuff, I think that's going to be an issue that has to be tackled.
So maybe I'll close with a summary question for the panel, just to get your thoughts on innovation and what do you think the most important things we can do now, either in the United States or in the developing world?
I need more time to think.
Stephen?
Sure. I think that one of the things we need to start thinking about in terms of encouraging the use of technology wisely is to encourage actually the educational base, mm-hmm. encourage the education of coders who have a good ethical base. They know what it is they're trying to do in terms of solving problems that are appropriate to their home country, to their region where they live. So encouraging coding for mobile platforms, for wherever the case may be. That's where I would want to turn.
I think specifically empathy.
I mean, I think innovation is out of having empathy for others, and specifically in emerging markets, you know, expressing, you know, solving real life problems that are scalable. You know, I think that's the focus, you know, because there are a lot of problems in emerging markets that, you know, simple fix can actually change, and to focus on that with technology. And I agree with, you know, the intellect as far as coding and access, you know, access to, you know, technology, access to developing skill sets to solve these problems. And, you know, I'm going to plug mServe again, iterative process. I mean, design and allowing people to fail, you know, within the whole context of developing technologies is definitely important. Because even with your coding skills, you also have to accept that part of the developing technologies is failure. So I think that's a necessary step in emerging markets, coming from the Caribbean myself, whereas you're looking just for A's, and instead of, okay, failure is good, what did you learn from the failure to move on? So,
mm-hmm. Okay,
so I'd say kind of radical public-private collaboration. There is so much opportunity. I mean, so much of our economy here and elsewhere is embedded in the public sector from a GDP perspective and healthcare and so on and so forth. I mean, I'm partially an Obamacare supporter. We won't get into that discussion. But I think it just blew me away that $600 million was spent on a website, even with the back-end stuff. Right? I mean, I don't get it. And so I think bringing the public and private sector together, not in the traditional way that it's been done, but to look at different frameworks where that collaboration can happen in a much less risky way would have pretty dramatic impact.
Well, I have learned several things on this panel. I've learned about liberation technology, smart slums, and my favorite, smart garbage cans. So I guess that is in our future. But I want to thank Stephen, Zia, and Kenfield for sharing your expertise with us. Thank you very much.
Thank you.